You ever watch this guy on television?
You all were not telling the truth, and you should not be trusted.
Congressman Matt Gaetz, thank you for what you did for your country tonight.
Be offended with the Democratic whip, not House Republicans.
Like a machine, Matt Gaetz.
Welcome to Hot Takes. This is Congressman Matt Gaetz. Let's talk about the news. There's economic news that's being reported by CNBC regarding the extent of private sector job losses. The top line is that we are starting to see those numbers flatten off, and we have not seen the same just cratering in private sector jobs that some economists were anticipating. So let's get into the numbers. In April, our country lost more private sector jobs than at any other month in our nation's history as a consequence of this Chinese coronavirus. We lost 19.6 million private sector jobs. And in May, the expectation is that that would continue at a pretty alarming rate. Economists were expecting 8.7 million private sector job losses in the month of May. But here's the, I guess, good news in context, given the broader challenges we face. We only lost 2.76 million jobs in May. So that is way less than was originally anticipated and expected. Mark Zandi, one of the chief economists at Moody's, is quoted as saying in the story, obviously an awful number, but not as catastrophic as expected. So let's now look into where those job losses are still happening and maybe what it says about the path for economic recovery that our nation needs to be on. So out of those 2.76 million jobs that were lost, we see 1.9 million of them in the service industry. And that makes a lot of sense to us because still within the service industry, we've not seen rebuild at a snapback rate because the public health guidelines are limiting the amount of revenue that a lot of these, you know, restaurants and other service-oriented businesses can maintain. And also without having a lot of the bars open, you lose a lot of the jobs associated with that sector. And then there were about 800,000 jobs lost in the goods-producing sectors of the economy, in the productive sectors of the economy. Now, here's what I think about that and that breakdown. The service economy will come back as soon as people are able to get out, move around, have confidence, spend money. What I think it's a lot harder to rebuild are those jobs in manufacturing, in production. So again, while it's really sad and challenging to deal with these numbers of job losses, when you really drill down into it, out of these 2.76 million jobs that we lost in May, I think that 1.9 million of those in the service industry may be quicker to snap back, which will be helpful. And then we've got to find ways within the productive sectors of our economy to ensure that supply chain, that workforce development, that the regulatory environment continues to be conducive to a rebuild and a restoration of American greatness. If we look back at really what got this economy going at the beginning of the Trump presidency, it's really, you know, I think three things. There's the confidence element, business confidence, consumer confidence, that there is the production element. You know, we became a nation that was more eager to produce energy, to produce goods, to utilize better trade policy so that we weren't just, you know, totally a service economy, but that we build and made things and that made our economy more resilient. And I know after coronavirus, we're even more interested in building out those productive sectors of the economy. And then I think the third leg of the stool was really investment. You know, you'll remember the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act created this tax amnesty for foreign capital to come back from overseas. And a great deal of that went into capital investment, build out. And when that investment was made, it only supercharged the confidence that was in the economy. So those three major elements rolling together, consumer confidence and investor confidence, driven by actual investment, driven by growing sectors of production in the economy. And obviously today, you know, we have seen a real challenge across the board, but particularly in the area of consumer confidence and in the confidence that people can make the investments, make the hires, and that the business environment and that the overall growth of America's economy will support those risks that businesses have to make, both large and small. And so that's why I think these May numbers are really important. I mean, if we were thinking that we were going to lose 8.75 million jobs, and we lost 6 million jobs fewer than was anticipated. Maybe, just maybe, with the strong monetary policy that the Fed has implemented, with the rescue package that the Congress passed, with the Paycheck Protection Program, trying to keep people engaged in the employment environment and atmosphere, and then maybe with the sound policy choices that my governor in Florida and some other governors are making around the country to try to get the economy going again, get open again. Those things working in concert might lead to consumer confidence being at the front edge of this recovery cycle that we've got to get into. So we'll keep watching those numbers, but I think it is absolutely essential that we bring America back, and with productive economies, with investment, and with people getting out there and spending money again, I'm sure that we will. There's a new report indicating good data for medical marijuana as a potential substitute for opioids. We all know that opioids have savaged families and communities and workplaces all throughout our great country. And it is frustrating to me that far too many people in politics and in Congress think that the way that we can show how much we care about the pain that opioids have caused is by spending more money and measuring our inputs rather than the outcomes that can actually help people. And so this study is from Columbia University. It's reported by Ben Alden with Marijuana Moment. And the Columbia University study shows that in states where there is access to a medical marijuana program, we are seeing a reduction as much as 20% in the prescribing of opioids. So again, in these states where people can utilize medical marijuana for pain, for other ailments that they're dealing with, you can see as much as a 72,000 daily dose reduction in hydrocodone, a highly addictive and dangerous drug that, I mean, 72,000 daily doses, if you can take those out of play, you really can impact the models of who's going to get addicted and the volume of that addiction. The study also reports a significant decrease in the prescribing of fentanyl. And I think the country has really become aware of how dangerous and deadly this fentanyl is, how people can get addicted to it, and then find out on the open street market a really high potency that can kill people. And just the overdoses have been tragic to deal with. But one thing that frustrates me is that our own government doesn't seem to take in this data and these studies with a great deal of focus or a great deal of, I think, attention. Here is one of the interviews that I conducted in the House Judiciary Committee with the acting head of the DEA, and it was very disappointing how little he knew about the evidence surrounding marijuana as a potential replacement, substitute, or just impacting force on the overall opioid prescription and death outcome data set.
Let's just take the circumstance where a state has said marijuana is medicine. Is it your view that that adds to the substance abuse problem?
It is.
The Minnesota Department of Health had a research project with over 2,000 patients who had intractable pain that used medical cannabis. And those patients saw opioids prescribed at a rate 38% less than people who were not using medical cannabis. Do you have any basis with which to disagree with that finding, that those patients saw a reduction in the need for opioids when they had access to medical cannabis?
So I'm not familiar with that study. I think there are a number of studies out there that talk when people are presented, whether I guess it would be with medical marijuana or with Tylenol or others, that there are many alternatives to opioids.
Do you acknowledge then that medical marijuana is an alternative to opioids?
No, I'm saying I don't know that study. So, I mean,
okay. Show that medical marijuana would increase the use of opioids? Are there any?
I don't know.
So you're the acting administrator of the DEA. You cannot cite a single study that indicates that medical marijuana creates a greater challenge with opioids, and you're unaware of the studies, including studies from the National Academy of Sciences, that demonstrate that medical marijuana can be an acceptable alternative to opioids. Is that what I'm understanding?
Yes.
And so we hope with this additional scientific information becoming available that there will be more study and more review between the causal relationship, not just the overall data in terms of higher or lower prescription amounts or death rates or intubations, but really looking at whether or not when people utilize medical marijuana, does that make them less likely to have to need that prescription? And if that is true, then maybe, just maybe in Congress, we should look to the solutions that don't cost the taxpayer more money, that don't just pour billions of dollars into treatment programs that are dubious in their success rate. Let's look at potentially a more natural option with medical marijuana that won't get people addicted to opioids in the first place. The beatings will apparently continue until the woketopia is achieved. That is the message from corporate media, from digital media, from big tech platforms, and even at times from corporate America. Today, we've got news that Snapchat is the most recent digital platform seeking to disadvantage President Trump and the America First voices who support him. Snapchat coming out with a ruling, I guess, that they will no longer allow President Trump's content to spread across the platform as anyone else's would be allowed to do. And their basis is that President Trump has incited racial violence. This is ridiculous. In every speech the president has given since the Floyd death, he, you know, in some or in part, comes together to ask for national unity, to ask for order and safety and protection on our streets, and certainly to call for justice against those who perpetrated this crime against Mr. Floyd. But there is no reason for these tech companies to try to constrain a national discussion when clearly one needs to take place. But see, they don't want a real discussion. They don't want a real exchange of ideas. They just want to bathe in each other's wokeness. And so I stand against Snapchat's decision to censor the president. But sadly, I think that this is the new normal. And we conservatives are going to have to find a way to fight back, because we can't win an argument if we can't make the argument. The president is doing everything he can to bring this country together. And if anything, it's big tech that's driving us apart. Drew Brees is apparently the latest to get labeled by the woke elements of society. They are demanding an apology because Drew Brees had the nerve to, I guess, call our country to national unity and national pride. Here are the comments of New Orleans Saints quarterback Drew Brees.
I will never agree with anybody disrespecting the flag of the United States of America or our country. Let me just tell you what I see or what I feel when the national anthem is played and when I look at the flag of the United States. I envision my two grandfathers who fought for this country during World War II, one in the Army and one in the Marine Corps, both risking their lives to protect our country and to try to make our country and this world a better place.
So Drew Brees says that we should stand for the nation, that we should come together and unify as a nation, that we should reject elements of division. And oh my gosh, the negative, just fire-breathing reaction from the left has been so disappointing and so impactful that actually today Drew Brees comes out and apologizes, says he was insensitive. And look, I always believe that if someone thinks that they've aggrieved another, one of the easiest things to do is offer an apology and make people feel better and show your empathy. But I don't believe that Drew Brees said anything wrong. I don't think that there's anything improper about calling our nation to love one another and love our country. I think Drew Brees was right in suggesting that justice has to be done in the Floyd case. I think we all agree with that. But oh my gosh, I mean, what a society we're living in where when you call for national unity, the woke left makes you apologize for it later. That's really, you know, what this is all about for some of them, not for all of them, but for the crazy left-wing Antifa folks. This isn't about healing. This is about maintaining division and violence and chaos as long as possible. And if you stand against that chaos, as Drew Brees did, then you're somehow like part of the patriarchy, part of the problem. Well, Drew Brees has been a force for good in the New Orleans community. He's been a force for good in the NFL. I don't think he had anything to apologize for. And I think it's a hell of a note that the pressures and forces in our society would ask someone to rebuke a statement that was so patriotic and fair and honorable. Just today, we are getting explosive reporting on the inner workings and goals and ambitions of the terrorist organization Antifa. Project Veritas, our friend James O'Keefe runs that organization. They actually got an insider in the Antifa organization, someone who was pegged to be a prospect there. That insider then collected video, collected audio recordings, and it's just very clear. I encourage you to check out the Project Veritas platform, but it's very clear that these are not folks engaged in politics. They are engaged in terrorism. They want to gouge eyes. They want to harm. They want to disrupt. They want clearly to make a point at the edge of weaponry and not at the tip of the tongue, as political speech would dictate. Take just a listen to some of the information that has been collected by Project Veritas on the truth about Antifa.
I've been undercover with Real City Antifa.
Don't be that f***ing guy with the damn spiked brass knuckles getting photos taken of you. Police are going to be like, perfect, we can prosecute these f***ers. Look up.
The whole goal of this, right, is to get out there and do dangerous things as safely as possible.
And so if you look at corporate media, if you look at corporate America, if you look at big tech and social media, they make these Antifa folks out to be like they're some sort of freedom fighters, like they're, you know, rights activists. But you're not enhancing someone's rights by gouging out someone's eye. You're not building stronger communities by burning things to the ground. And that's why, as the congressman for Florida's 1st Congressional District, I will stand against Antifa, against this domestic terrorist organization. The mainstream media wanted to make a big deal out of the fact that DOD advisor James Miller had resigned from the Trump administration as a consequence of the president's desire to travel to the church across the street from the White House that had been burned and to hold a Bible up at that place of worship. What they don't want to tell you is that this is not just some bystander to politics. The DOD advisor's name is James Miller. He was a donor to President Obama's campaign. He is a donor to the Joe Biden 2020 campaign. And look, in America, people ought to be free to donate to whatever political cause they choose. But then when they are engaged in politics, as I am, as the president is, as others are, then the media should not give them like the veneer of impartiality when making these decisions. And so the media would have you believe that James Miller departed because of just some austere concern that he could no longer, you know, be in the administration. But the reality is this is someone who probably is, just looking for their shot. And if they think that shot's going to come under Biden, and if they think that, you know, they can help Biden in some way, well, that's just the same politics by different means. But if you go and check out the National Pulse, my friend Natalie Winters wrote up a great piece that really shows that this wasn't an act of patriotism. It was an act of politics for James Miller to try to make a point and resign from the Trump administration. My suspicion is we'll get plenty of great patriots who want to go in and fight alongside this president to keep our country great. Thanks so much for listening to Hot Takes with Matt Gaetz. Really appreciate it if you'd leave us a review or rating. Let us know if you like the show. We'll be back tomorrow with more Hot Takes.